Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
À tous de DBO, attention pour les décomptes finales.
All engines are started.
That looks really good.
So we'd like it to stir up your cryo tank.
Oh, wow, it's going up so slowly.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Allumage AP, décollage.
Yes, it's the Euro remix of the Space Boffins jingle, welcoming you to the 7th anniversary of Space Boffins with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson.
Well, we're in partnership with the Naked Scientists, and we've got a definite Euro theme this week as Richard visits the European spaceport in French Guiana, where the new Ariane 6 launch pad is taking shape. And we talked to the German astronaut who's training with the Chinese.
You're outside on the sea and you check out your emergency equipment, and it's so nice and relaxed, like floating there. I just, for a moment, I thought like I only need music and then it would have been my Hawaii feeling.
We're joined by a guest from the first Space Boffins podcast. It's like production. Science correspondent for BBC News, Jonathan Amos. 7 years on, Jonathan. We're basically all doing the same job, aren't we?
Hopefully some of us have improved over that time.
When you say that.
Speak for yourself.
I mean, yeah. The space business has changed. Let me tell you what was in Space Boffins podcast.
Do.
Imaginatively titled Space Boffins Podcast 1. I don't think I understood hashtags or metadata or anything. So it had David Parker as well, who's now moved on.
He's a big man now.
Yeah, he's a big man.
He was with the UK Space Agency then when we interviewed
him. He was, yeah. So
now he's ESA's head of human... No, head of...
Robotic and Human Space Flight.
Human Space Flight.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. So we also talked about the end of the space shuttle. So that was the end of the space shuttle.
Me.
Yeah, it seems so long ago. We had an interview. I think we had an interview the following week, actually, with a newly qualified astronaut, Tim Peake.
Oh, him. I remember him.
Whatever happened to him. Yeah. And we asked whether the UK would ever support human spaceflight.
What was the answer we gave? Did we say yes?
It's unclear.
Oh,
we
okay.
were sort of vague
we
about
hedged our
it.
Bets,
we hedged
didn't
our
we?
Bets and talked politically. But, I mean, that is extraordinary how much, particularly when it comes to human spaceflight and the UK, and maybe the end of the shuttle, how much things have changed in that time.
Things have flipped round, haven't they? I mean, at that stage, I don't think any of us sort of foresaw the whole Tim Peake thing and how that would take off, the mission that he had. I mean, he's a rock star now, isn't he? I mean, you walk into some events where Tim comes in and you've got all of these kids, and it is literally, you know, the Beatles coming in.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's lovely to see the way their eyes light up. And it's that, I think he's been a very good role model. And I know he sort of does stuff with the Girl Guides and Scouts. And I saw him at Farnborough last year when he was... I think it was last year or the year before when the kids, like you say, you know, he comes on, the kids go wild. But it's a look that says, I love all this stuff. I love space. I love science. I love Tim. And I think that aspect of it, he's managed really, really well.
Yeah, and credit where credit is due, I think. We mentioned David Parker then. Of course, back then he was a senior figure in the UK Space Agency. And they had to get him that seat on that mission. And, of course, that took quite a bit of negotiation, came down to the Napoli ESA ministerial conference, which was, can't remember, it was the one before the last one before the last one or something like that. But anyway, and the UK putting 20 million euros on the table to fix a dispute between the Germans and the French into what will become the service module for the Orion capsule, whenever we see that. And that kind of changed things there and then, and the rest has been history.
Well, let's start by heading to Kourou in French Guiana. Now, this is what most of the European spaceport sounds like. The vast site is, appropriately enough, around the size of Brussels, and it's surrounded by jungle. The area is dotted with these metal-clad buildings where satellites and rockets are tested and assembled. There's a rocket fuel factory and launch pads for Ariane 5 and the smaller Vega launcher. Well, the latest construction project is the launch pad for Europe's new 62-metre-high Ariane 6 launcher, being developed at a cost, according to Jonathan Amos of the BBC, of 2.4 billion euros.
Must be true.
Must be true. It's due for its maiden flight in 2020, but there's a lot of work still to do. With our hard hats on, overlooking the site, I spoke to Charlotte Besco, head of the European Space Agency ESA office in Kourou. We're on the edge of the Ariane 6 launch site, under construction, as you can probably hear. There are, what, around us, about six, seven cranes. There's the gantry, which will become the main structure that moves over the Ariane 6 rocket. And then there's this enormous concrete ramp. And this is for the flames. This will protect the blast, if you like, from the rocket.
It serves several purposes. One is to channel the exhaust fumes from the rocket. A second is to allow us to do what we call the deluge. We throw lots of water on it, and that reduces the vibrations, so it reduces the impact on the launcher and the payload, and it also reduces the toxic fallout. That's very important.
The size of this, I mean, the size of the whole site, for a start, the spaceport is enormous, and you only really get that when you're driving around between each part of that. But the size of this, again, it's all big stuff, isn't it?
It's very big stuff. I've never seen anything so big. I'm sure we're setting a lot of records. And it would be wonderful to have an image of the portique, or the gantry, as we call it, next to, I don't know, the Notre Dame Cathedral or St. Paul or something, just to get an... It's very hard to see it because it's rising straight out of the flat ground, so it's nothing to compare it to. But it will be 90 metres high once it's finished.
And this is a 90-metre-high building that has to move.
Yes.
So you have the rocket on the launch pad with this 90-metre building around it, and then that building has to shift backwards. There's a lot of engineering going on here.
It's what we did in the old days for Ariane 4. It's also what we're doing for Vega, and it's also what they're doing for Soyuz. So it's a proven technology, except this time we're doing it on a bigger scale. But in terms of preparing the launcher, it is quicker, it's more efficient, it allows people to work in safe conditions, and also from a weather point of view, it's more convenient.
Speed is one of the keys here, but you are looking to knock down the time to put the rocket together on the launch pad from 35 days with Ariane 5 to 12 days with Ariane 6. I mean, that's a huge change.
Well, we have learned something in these last 20 years. I mean, we started working... The Ariane 5 became operational in the late 90s. And so, obviously, we learn as we go. But this kind of big construction, you don't just change it from one day to the next. And so we integrated everything we know and learned into this site.
And how new will Ariane 6 be? I mean, how much of an evolution is it? How much is it, I suppose, a revolution, if you like, in making this... It's a competitive market and competing in that market.
We aim to make something that can be very attractive in terms of price and service to the customers, that can be very versatile in terms of the payload we can launch into orbit, and be able to respond to the many different orbital requirements that we have, because we face institutional payloads with very exotic missions, but we also face our traditional market, which is the geostationary payloads, and we want to cater for all of them.
And that's interesting with your role here. So European Space Agency, ESA, has put the money into making this all possible, but you will also be a client for many of the launches from here. So you have a lot invested in this.
ESA is a big organization. We channel a lot of the space research in Europe in many fields, like Earth observation, navigation, science, technology. And so we have many hats. And launcher infrastructure and launcher development is part of that. And at the moment, on site is brilliant because we have the Galileo launch that's coming up here. We have Beppe Colombo going to Mercury. We have Aulus, who is arriving. And we have METOP, who is arriving. So we have four different projects on site currently, which is a major challenge for ESA and for CSG, but it's wonderful.
And in terms of the investment in this, which will also launch commercial
satellites and need to compete. What's the thinking behind that from the ESA perspective? Why put money into something like this?
There are many reasons. One is that we have always the political will that we want an independent access to space. If we don't have our own European launch pad, then we will be always dependent on others. And Ariane 5 has proven in the past to be a very competitive launcher. Ariane 4 as well. They both work very, very well. We are competitive and we do good work here.
So talk me through what you hope this will be like in, well, we're getting, what, 2-3 years' time when you see the first launch. How different will this be?
Well, at the moment, we're standing in a big building site with piles of concrete and sand and rubble all over the place and trucks moving and crane moving. And the final product will be very simple, very streamlined. It will almost look elegant. And there should be, you know, really, really simple. That's how we're going to save time. There will be fewer operations, there will be fewer manipulations, there will be less transport, and so fewer bottlenecks in the processing. From a client point of view, it should offer quicker turnaround times, quicker ways into space.
And are you looking forward to seeing that first launch from here? Because just the scale of the structures here, just the scale of those flumes, where you can imagine the exhaust coming off that, it's going to be spectacular, particularly the larger Ariane 6 with four solid rockets around it.
From my personal perspective, I find every launch absolutely spectacular, and I'm not just saying that to be, you know, to be politically correct. I do find every launch fantastic. Every launch is different. Every launch campaign is a challenge. Every client is an individual, you know, is an individual client. They have their own needs. And every successful launch is really, I mean, is brilliant. But of course, this will be a big spectacle. Unfortunately, we cannot be close enough to appreciate it. But we'll hear it.
And it's not, I think people forget, this is not simple. This is not simple technology. It's not cheap technology either.
I wouldn't talk about expensive or cheap. That's not the issue. Space is complicated. A small error made somewhere along the track can cause tremendous damage and delays. So it's just complex. The devil is in the details, and we don't get a second chance. So we have to ensure that it's properly done. This takes time and resources, but the end result, in my opinion, is absolutely worth it.
My apologies for the overuse of words like big, enormous, huge and vast, but it was, and in my defence, I was quite jet-lagged. That's Charlotte Besko, head of the ESA office in Kourou, and I'll put some pictures of the site on our Facebook page, Twitter feed, and possibly also Instagram.
In fact, you've probably, if you've been looking at our Facebook page and the space, I'm laughing just at the thought of it, I suppose, but you see Richard in a variety of poses that have not really been seen since those in a knitwear catalogue, where Charlotte was saying about we have many hats. That's the sort of poses that Richard is in, modelling various hard hats at a very jaunty angle in front of a launch pad.
It's going to be supporting us, that, the Space Boffins calendar. Richard in hard hats.
Oh, God, it's terrible.
Maybe different type of hats for
every
month.
Anyway, putting that thought aside, Jonathan, there was a talk there about competitiveness. Mm. But the real reason, though, to do this is strategic, so that Europe has its own launch system.
Independent access to space, that's where it all started, and that is an underlying driver. And, you know, the Ariane 5 is an amazing vehicle. I should just say, I absolutely want to be there for the Ariane 6. For the maiden flight of Ariane 5, I just started as an editor on network radio for the BBC, and it was my first programme. And I had it all organised. I thought, this is fantastic. I've got the whole running order sorted out and all the rest of it. And when it was about 20 minutes to go, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and they started gesticulating towards a screen that was hanging from the ceiling. And it was all this debris coming down from the sky in French Guiana as the Ariane 5 had let go on that very first mission. So I have a little bit of an association to an Ariane 5, a bit of a nightmare association to it. Turned out to be an extraordinary vehicle, not just because it's been so reliable down the years, but also if you speak to industry people, it puts the satellites precisely where they need to go. Now, I know we had this slight anomaly recently where it did the complete opposite. It got them up there, but it didn't put them in the right part of the sky. But that has been an exception to what has been a marvellous rule down the years. But they do need to bring the price down. It is a very, very expensive rocket. And will the Ariane 6 be commercially competitive? It probably will not get down to the prices that Elon Musk can offer with his 15 or so reusable rockets. But here's the thing. Rockets are not just about price. They're about reliability. They're about schedule. Those are the two other factors you have to bear in mind. It's no good having the cheapest rocket if you can't launch on time and it explodes when you launch. So those three together, price, reliability and schedule, they all have to be there. The other thing is, as you've hinted here, is geopolitics. And, you know, one of the sort of underlies here for the Ariane 6 is a commitment from the European Commission, but also from ESA member states, to support the Ariane 6. So we've seen the European Commission commit to launch Galileo on the Ariane 6, Copernicus as well, all of the future Sentinels. You will not see them go up on any other vehicle other than an Ariane 6 or a Vega. Now, will that be enough? I think Ariane Group, the people that make the Ariane 6, say they need six institutional launches a year from Europe to get them into a competitive position, even with the reduced price of the Ariane 6. So are there six a year around Europe? There probably are, but it requires that commitment, which hasn't yet come, I should say, from the ESA member states to support the vehicle in the way that the Commission has suggested everybody should be doing.
And we should mention, because we started the podcast talking about the UK backing human space flight. Yeah. The one thing the UK doesn't do is back rockets.
No, it doesn't.
Launches, or back these particular launches.
Well, and, you know, for the UK, there are very few, how can I put this, really indigenous national payloads that you would put on the Ariane 5. The only example I can think of in recent years is probably Skynet. They went up on Ariane 5. But if you look at the big companies like Inmarsat in London, well, they look across the market. And those companies, they like to kind of go with the different rocket players. They don't like to go with just one. They need more than one. They need possibly minimum two in the market to keep everybody's toes, keep everybody on their toes, but also to give them flexibility should one of them hit a brick wall and that particular route to orbit fails for a period of time. So, yeah, it's a bit difficult for the UK because we don't have those big institutional payloads like they do in Germany or France. We put our money into ESA. That's kind of where we go.
I'd be interested to know actually what the financial figures and profits are for SpaceX, because the people I've spoken to about commercial space industry and commercial spaceports have all said it's difficult to make a profit. It seems to be, well, either it's government subsidy or it's some rich man's passion. And it is usually a rich man.
Okay. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, there are a few points. I'll come back to the rich man in just a second. I mean, SpaceX would not be where they are today were it not for NASA. They've had the seed funding there. But also the size of the American satellite market is such that you can guarantee a large number of payloads a year. And the Americans are not going to launch a national security payload on anything other than an American rocket. So that comes back to the geopolitics as well. So, you know, they have more to play with over there in that sense. But they are going to need to recover all of the investment that they have made down the years. I think if you looked at the balance sheet now, kind of on a day-to-day basis, probably SpaceX do turn a bit of a profit, but they've got a lot to pay back. And Elon Musk has been very clear that he's not going to suddenly drop his prices to rock bottom because he needs to recover that investment. So, you know, he will look very carefully at the price that the Ariane 6 comes onto the market with, and he will place himself just below that so that he has the price advantage. But to come back to the rich man, of course, there's Jeff Bezos. I mean, you know, this guy has quietly worked away in the background, hasn't done any of the fuss and the fanfare or anything, and turned up with the new Shepard vehicle. Superb, you know. Nobody noticed almost that he'd been doing this. Fantastic. And, you know, he's probably, you know, he may well be taking paying passengers into orbit, suborbital space, let's be correct about it, before Richard Branson. How long has Richard Branson been going at the whole spaceship thing? I mean, it's been 10 years or so now, hasn't it? You know? Yeah. You know, it'll be neck and neck. I don't know who will be first up there. But then he's got a big rocket too, isn't he? He's got this new Glenn. Rocket. He's also threatened us with a new Armstrong rocket as well, which will be even bigger. I was at Kennedy.
He's got the best name.
He's
given some thought to that.
I was at Kennedy a few weeks ago for the launch of the TESS exoplanet satellite. And to get into Kennedy, we drove past the Blue Origin factory there. Now, talk about big, right? That word applies to the factory. Very spectacular.
Does it bother you that all that's quite opaque? Whereas obviously the European Space Agency and Ariane Group and the various companies involved in Ariane 6, this is very much out in the open. We can see the prices. It's taxpayers' money. We can see what's being built. They take journalists out there to have a look at it. Whereas, you know, Jeff Bezos and to maybe a lesser extent Elon Musk, it's all very secretive.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was interesting. Actually, just to use the example of TESS, there was an anomaly on the scheduled launch day of some description. And we're all standing there at the desk in the Kennedy Space Center saying, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? And we didn't really get any information, you know. And the two SpaceX guys are sitting there with their SpaceX polo shirts because they're the contracted launch company to put up a NASA payload. And they're going, well, we'll update you, we'll update you, we'll update you. And, of course, we never really got a full explanation as to why that launch was put back.
And they got very defensive about it.
I sort of contrast that with, you know, the old shuttle days where, you did get a running commentary. Mike Moses, who is the process flow for the shuttle, who's now one of the big cheeses at Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic company. You know, he couldn't stop talking. I mean, he explained every nut and bolt in the shuttle to you. So, yeah, I think you've just got to get used to a different way of doing things. British Airways and Lufthansa, they don't explain the ins and the outs of their business to you, do they? I mean, it's changed. Everything is changing. Yeah.
Well, we'll have more from Kourou in our August podcast, including the Vega rocket. Still to come this time, what's the Chinese spacecraft like inside? We meet the European astronaut that's trained in it. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. Oh, sorry. That wasn't me, actually.
It wasn't me.
It was the same person who poured the water during that Jonathan was talking.
I don't have any paper.
Would you like some?
No, I don't want any paper.
No.
I'm just doing a shopping list.
We'll have more from Kourou in our August podcast. Still to come, what's the Chinese spacecraft like inside? We meet the European astronaut that's trained in it.
You might not associate grassy banks with the coast.
It is a bit like stepping abroad for a second.
Well, I'm here on the Ningaloo Reef. Take people swimming with whale sharks.
Just another day at the office.
Yeah, just another day at the office, mate.
I have you loud and clear.
Hello.
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 Welcome.
The Naked Scientist podcast takes you to the science topics you need to hear about.
Physics, medicine, nature.
Keep up to date with what's going on in the field.
First this week, the announcement from LIGO.
And find out the answers to every question you never thought to ask.
What kills more people, sharks or selfies?
To subscribe, search Naked Scientist podcast or head over to our website.
This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
You can get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you. And on Facebook, you can find a video of a rather sweaty Richard by the Ariane 5 and Vega launch pads. I was a bit concerned that you did look as though you were enjoying that a little bit too much, particularly as the trip was open to both of us and Richard opened the email first.
Did you see the frogs?
No, we saw some giant spiders, saw some monkeys, not much wildlife at all. You can hear, I mean, that's the thing about jungle. You hear this amazing wildlife and you just see some ants.
Yeah. In fact, you know, you said you were last there when it was, the Ariane 5 was happening. When we were last there together, was 1999, February, for an Ariane 4 launch. And we got to actually stand on the Ariane 5 launch pad. And that was amazing to actually be stood there where you knew, you know, fire and fury would be raining down once it was going. And
one of my hard hat pictures does feature me by a fueled Ariane 5. And that's extraordinary, the access. And we're coming back to talking about, you know, not knowing what Jeff Bezos is doing or what's going on, to actually have the access to get so close to a real rocket. And I can't help the sort of excitement of this whole thing. You know, we can talk about prices and launches, all the rest of it, but it's really exciting stuff.
So the thing I'd really like to have a go at, the umbilical tower that, you know, stands next to the Ariane 5, they work on that, clearly. And there is this giant sock that goes down the middle of it. So if there's a problem or something and people are on the launch pad and they have to get out really quickly, of course, it'd take too long to climb down a stepladder or go in a lift or anything. And you jump into this sock.
Like a water slide.
Like a water slide. And what you're supposed to do is just push your elbows out and that will slow you down. And then you just
take the skin off your elbows out of the water. Yes.
But I like the idea of that.
Great experience.
A great experience, wouldn't it? I hope they have one of those for the Ariane 6.
Before we go on, here's some any other business that we've got to do last time. But I do need to set it up properly in a podcasty way. So here we go. Previously on Space Boffins.
Skylab Houston, everybody around here has looked at the bird and it looks real good.
Roger, roger.
And you're being awaited by the USS Ticonderoga. And we're waiting to see you back here in Houston, too.
All righty. You can relay to the Tycho. We've got their Fox Corbin and our hook is down.
That was from the first Skylab mission, and it completely baffled us. And Mick Bremner, who's in the UK, he wrote on our Facebook page, "The Skylab banter at the end must be from a naval aviator. He's just been told that the USS Ticonderoga, which is an aircraft carrier, is waiting for them. He says that their hook is down, alluding to the arrestor hook, which naval aircraft use to grab the wire across the carrier's deck. As for fox carpet, I've no idea."
Fortunately, though, Leonard Frankel in Melbourne added, "I tried to work out what fox corpin means, gave up and googled Skylab 2 and our hook is down." See, top journalism there. That got an excerpt from Homesteading Space, the Skylab story, that explains the whole bit, saying it's fox corpin and that means the carrier's heading. So also part of joking about landing on the carrier, altogether meaning tell the carrier we know they're heading and have deployed our hook for landing. Oh. There we go.
I love the way everybody sort of got together to try and work out.
See, that's audience interaction.
I also like the way, actually, there's some guy...
We've been striving for that for 7 years.
No, I should have got his name, actually, the guy who replied either Facebook or something, with a picture of him with the T-shirt saying Orcs. Was it Orcs in...
SCE to Orcs.
SCE to Orcs, yep. Which is... do you know that, John?
No, I was just thinking that the new NASA administrator, he used to do that, didn't he? He used to land planes on carrier decks and stuff like that. So he would know all about it.
The guy that now believes in climate change.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Pleased to hear it.
Yeah. Well, next, my new favourite astronaut, Matthias Maurer, my co-commentator for the recent Alexander Gerst mission to the International Space Station. Now, Matthias only recently qualified as an ESA astronaut, but since 2012, he's been building bridges with the Chinese space programme. Last year, along with fellow ESA astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti, he took part in sea survival training with Chinese astronauts near the coastal city of Yantai.
There is a brand new center that is only used for sea survival training, and there we had our own accommodation. It looked like a oversized youth hostel, I have to say, where all the astronauts, the Chinese astronauts, and we, Samantha and me, lived in the same corridor, so door to door, and we shared the food. So we had breakfast, lunch and dinner together, and for 2 weeks we lived together. And that was a quite intense experience, because it felt like being part of a family. And that's completely different from my training experience that I have in Houston, where I live in a hotel or where I rent an apartment and I meet only my colleagues during the 2 or 3 hour training session, and for the rest of the day I'm independent.
Was that quite good in a way that you actually, because you can, I mean, it's an obvious, if you were in a business, it's an obvious sort of team building idea that you're all together and you'll either get on or you'll start to really hate each other.
Absolutely. In the West, I have to say, in Europe or the US, we do team building training. So we have HBP training, so human behavior and performance training. We are brought together and we share a certain amount of time and we are exposed to a difficult environment to see how the team dynamic evolves and develops. And in China, you don't need this because you live together, and the Chinese astronauts, they always live together. They even spend their vacation together. So they know each other perfectly well. And so they are like brothers and sisters. And when I lived there, and Samantha had the same feeling, we felt so warm-heartedly accepted into their family. So it's really a nice feeling, and I immediately thought like I could start tomorrow with them and fly to space, and I knew it would have been perfect.
What was the spacecraft like? Because it looks very much like an adopted, slightly adapted Soyuz spacecraft, which the Russians use. What was it actually like, though?
So the spacecraft that we used for the sea survival training was only the return capsule. It's much bigger. It has a larger diameter and it is higher. So for the sea survival training, that was really nice because in the Russian capsule, when you land on water, you change from the spacesuit and you change into a rubber suit that protects you in the water. And the Soyuz is so tiny, so cramped that only one by one you can change. And the other two need to help you and need to pull on the trouser and on the spacesuit so that you can change and dress. In the Chinese capsule, you have so much space, so we could easily, the three of us together at the same time, undress and dress into the rubber suit, and we have so much space that we even have inflatable rubber boats, which we don't have on the Russian space capsule. So the procedure is you change from your pressure or your space suit into the rubber suit, then you open the hatch, and the commander gets out. He takes the first dinghy, inflates it, and then he gives the command that the other two exit, and the other two share a larger dinghy. And so it's very easy. And then you're outside on the sea, and you check out your emergency equipment, and it's so nice and relaxed, like floating there. For a moment, I thought, like, I only need music, and then it would have been my Hawaii feeling. While the Russian sea survival is you jump into the water, and there is no boat, and so you need to actually stay in the water, and it gets cold and chilly, and so it's much, much harder.
So does that suggest that the Chinese have almost jumped a level of technology that's actually quite advanced? And were you surprised by that, the state of the spacecraft?
I was surprised by the dimensions that they have in this capsule, and they have all the functionality, and obviously they had a good look at the Russian hardware. They learned what was the good parts, and they also looked like, okay, what can we improve? Because, I mean, the Soyuz is 50 years old, so obviously in 50 years engineering had done a huge step forward, and they're clever people, and they're very focused, and so I think their space station will also be a very modern one, and they will be very successful in space.
And what stage are you at now with your relationship with the Chinese? And I mean, what do you come away with from that experience?
So we are now at a stage where we talked a lot with the Chinese and we said, okay, now we understand each other much better and we want to fly a European astronaut in the future to your space station. We had a first training experience of a taikonaut training in Europe. That was actually our HBP training, so the crew performance and behavior training, in a cave in Sardinia. And, he's a great guy, so he fit in easily into this ISS crew that trained in the cave. And last year, Samantha and me were in China. The next step would be, and actually we hoped for that it will be 2018, but it might slip to 2019, system training in the Chinese space capsule. So the Shenzhou capsule, it would be to familiarize ourselves how this capsule works. There is a big difference with the Soyuz. The Soyuz has a left seater, which is the co-pilot. And we Europeans are always eager. So like, oh, we want to become co-pilot. So we went to China and we said, like, we need to negotiate hard. So we asked, we want to have a left seat. And they said, like, okay. And we thought, like, something's wrong here. So, and then we only figured out that the right seat is co-pilot.
So where does this leave you? You have yet to fly. You could go for Soyuz. You could maybe fly with the Chinese. You could maybe fly in one of the new United States spacecraft, like the Dragon or Orion.
Well, correct. I'd like to add one more option that I have. It's the SLS. So I was hired in the astronaut selection for missions to the ISS, the moon or beyond, and so all these options are open, and it's like now the Chinese space station even is another option, and that leaves it very unclear for me, like, okay, which spacecraft will I fly in? And flying in the spacecraft also defines the language that you need to speak. So in the Soyuz you need to speak Russian, in the Chinese spacecraft obviously you need to be able to speak Chinese, and in the other vehicles it would be English. And to keep all options open, I learn all these languages.
So how's your Chinese?
It's good, but it needs still some improvement. Last year for the sea survival training, we had the training in Chinese, and the taikonauts also speak some English, so it was a mix of both. But sea survival training, it's much easier for communication, because if somebody tells you this is the water, I mean, it's obvious, you see it, you understand it. But running an experiment, reading a procedure that has maybe 20 pages written in Chinese characters, that is still a killer for me, and it might even remain a killing argument. And so one of the discussions that we have with the Chinese colleagues is like, how can we enable non-native Chinese speakers being efficient, being fast, working on procedures? So could we maybe have bilingual procedures, translate key procedures into English, or have a different way to make it easier for us and avoid the complicated Chinese character system.
Can you give me a demonstration? I don't speak any Chinese, so you could say anything.
我的名字是马天，我是欧洲航天员，我很喜欢去太空和中国航天员一起工作。
And what does that mean?
It means my name is Matthias Mora, my Chinese name is Ma Tian, it means the horse of the heaven. And I would very much love to fly into space together with Chinese astronauts and to work on the Chinese space station.
ESA astronaut Matthias Mora. And
Great guy.
Yeah, it's really,
I love
brilliant.
Him.
I'd say my new favourite astronaut. I really want human performance and behaviour training.
So I remember when that class of astronaut was selected, you know, the Tim Peake class, because he essentially now he joins
he's part of
that class, the Shenanigans, they call themselves, don't they? And it was very apparent to me when I was put in a room. I actually went when they were selected, but before they formally joined ESA, we went to Kennedy to have a look at a shuttle and also the Ares 1 rocket. I don't know if you remember the old Constellation, wasn't it? Was going to
what's
be
become
the
SLS.
Yeah, it was become. Yeah. Well, but this was sort the kind of. Yeah. This was that there was going to be two rockets. There was going to be a mini rocket that went up, took the astronauts up, and then there'd be a big rocket which you would join, blah, 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 and all the rest of it. So we went to see this stuff just to sort of hang out at Kennedy. And just being with that group was amazing, because instantly they got on. And that was no accident. You know, these individuals are chosen very, very carefully to be able to live in a tin can for 6 months and get on with people. So it's no surprise that he's a nice guy, that you want to get on with him, because that's one of the primary reasons. He has to do all of the other stuff, obviously. He's got to have the expertise. But his personnel skills have to be tip-top.
So I think also it's a big advantage, I think, for Europeans, particularly mainland Europe, because they are often living bordering several other countries. The people there, whenever we go to mainland Europe, you always feel slightly embarrassed that they will converse in French, German, Dutch,
indeed.
Italian. Yeah. And there's, you know, there we have a German doing an interview in Moscow with in English, who can also speak Chinese. I know Samantha Cristoforetti speaks about six
She's
languages.
She's an amazing linguist.
She is absolutely incredible. But I do also think, because it was 2 years ago, I discovered that Samantha was learning Chinese. Mm. And I thought, whoa, this is, you know, a lot of foresight here. That's beginning of 2016. And it does feel as though ESA has played a very smart game here, in that they're covering all their bases in terms of who they can work with.
Yeah, obviously there are these long-term issues that the Americans have with China. And so I doubt you're going to see, certainly in the near term, even the medium term, an American mission going to the future Chinese space station. It does make me laugh somewhat, though, because I remember the struggles that Tim had learning Russian, Tim Peake. And whenever I used to see Tim, I said, how are the language lessons going? And he'd go, oh no. I said, come on, just all you have to do is to be able to ask for a beer. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. If you can go into a bar and say, can I have a beer in the local language, it's fine. I don't think that works on the space station.
It doesn't work on the space station. Yeah.
No.
But the thought of Tim having to learn Chinese, I think that probably would be his big nightmare, I think.
But now, you know, Europe can effectively, they don't have to rely on America and they don't have to rely on Russia. They have their own spaceport and they could also work with the Chinese. I think that's
it's
very strategic.
Absolutely. And you're already seeing a number of experiments going up on Chinese missions. Germans have been very forward in doing that. And we're only going to see more of it. And, you know, I fully expect the first sort of, if not Russian, obviously foreign Western astronaut to go on the new Chinese space station to be a European. Definitely.
So there's this theme here of European independence in space. Are you nervous of the Trump presidency in terms of what he's going to do for space? And there's a brilliant video going around about what is Space Force. And it was very clear from that particular film, although I think it was for a comedy program, that no one was quite clear what the Space Force actually was,
yeah.
Apart from the fact that it potentially breaks the Outer Space Treaty for peaceful purposes.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm more worried about Europe and the United Kingdom and Brexit.
With Galileo.
Well, I mean, more generally speaking, yeah. Because of the way that space is organised in Europe. You know, you have this separate legal entity, which is called the European Space Agency, and this large organisation called the European Union. They are not one and the same. And yet you're in this strange position now where what the European Union wants to do in space is becoming more and more what ESA is doing in space. And so how those two organizations go forward together is going to be very interesting, with one of the largest countries in Europe, one of the biggest economies, being outside of one of those organizations. So, you know, presidents come and go, but we're about to hardwire a relationship or rewire the relationship, space relationships in Europe, you know, for the next 10, 20 years and even longer. So I think that's kind of more of a concern to me when I look at the space landscape.
I mean, you must have heard the same as I have for the last, ever since it was announced that we would be leaving Europe. People within the space agency have said to me, sure they've said to you, off the record, this is not good. And I have heard already over the last year, well, over a year ago, of jobs and contracts not going to British scientists and organisations because they were worried about the future. So we're already losing work within the space industry. Do you see this? I mean, I know the UK is working on having its own spaceport, but they don't have their own launches. Do you see this as a potentially the end of something that is really big and important economically for the UK?
No, I don't see that. I think there's a lot of innovation in the United Kingdom, and whatever negotiated settlement London and Brussels come to in the end, there will always be a space industry in the United Kingdom, and it'll be quite vibrant as well. I have no doubt about that. But there are these big projects, and we've yet to see how they will fall out and the relationships that we have. Personally, on a totally personal level here, and I'm not speaking in any sort of, how should we say, authoritative fashion here, I doubt the UK will go forward with its own satellite navigation system. There are a number of roadblocks down the road
that I agree
will make it very hard for the UK to do that. And, you know, also that we've seen the Treasury taking, weapon systems off carriers and all the rest of it because it's too expensive. So, those are long-term projects which they would have to commit to and commit to the long-term. And, politics is a short-term game. So whether, that kind of approach will work, I'm doubtful. But, this is not totally dead in the water yet. There is a negotiation still going on. And so, I hope that they come to some agreeable settlement. One of the best interventions I've seen, I think, is from Tom Enders, the boss of Airbus, who said to Brussels, he said to London, look, there are two nuclear powers in Europe. One of them is France and the other one is the United Kingdom. So the idea that actually we can just sort of, put the United Kingdom over there and somehow it is a third country outside of Europe, just doesn't wash. I know the UK is coming out of the European Union, but it isn't just another third country. It isn't. And so Brussels and London have to work through that and decide what sort of relationship it's going to be in the future. And of course, everything cascades from that. And it's not just the space industry. It's fish. It's, everything else as well. We need clarity. We need clarity not just on Galileo, but Copernicus as well. Nobody seems to talk about Copernicus, the Earth observation.
I think we'll do that in a future podcast. You
need to,
I think,
to do that. That's very, very important.
Absolutely. Our thanks to BBC Science correspondent John Amos, our first and now 7 years later.
Yay.
Back again. I want to do it a little bit sooner next time, I think.
I'll check my diary.
All right. Good.
Do get in touch with us. Any comments, questions, suggestions, within reason, obviously. Space Boffins is a Boffin Media production in partnership with The Naked Scientist. We're supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium. Next time, as I mentioned, more from French Guiana when I go inside the control bunker. I know! And the Vega launch pad. In the meantime, Sue will be at Farnborough Air Show, so do say hello to
her. On Space Day, I'll be there.
Thanks for listening.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.